It's a pleasure to be back, but even just virtually. So yes, I will tell you about analytics in retargeting of cosmological correlators, which is the title of my recent work that I've done in collaboration with Victor Gorbenko and Shota Komatsu. And so in this work, what we study is quantum field theory on rigid de Sitter background. So both quantum field theory and rigid mean that you're not considering dynamical gravity, okay? So just no graviton around. And so let's start with the very basics. De Sitter is a maximally symmetric space-time, which describes an exponentially expanding universe. And two convenient ways to visualize it are these two. So on the left, I drew it as a hyperboloid embedded inside a higher dimensional Minkowski space. And what you see instead on the right is the Penrose diagram, which looks just like a square. And from both pictures, what we see is that there are two, let's say, asymptotic regions for very large times and in the far future, in the far past. And it's also clear that actually there is also a contracting part of the universe. So the universe basically describes first a contraction and then an expansion, and both are exponential. So strictly speaking, what I'm describing here is called global De Sitter. Global because we cover the full Penrose diagram, and this is the metric that describes this space-time. Okay, so the spatial slices are d-dimensional spheres, which we take to have the round metric. And it's also quite clear from the embedding space picture what is the isometry of this space-time. It's the Lorentz group of the Minkowski space in which we are embedding it, which is SO1 d plus 1, and which we can also, of course, think about as the Euclidean conformal group in d dimensions. Okay, so I already said, but of course ask questions at any time if you have. So this group does in fact act as a Euclidean conformal group on the future boundary, actually also the future, the past boundary of the geometry. And this means that if we consider what we will call late-time correlators, which are just insertion of local operators on this surface, they will behave like they will be covariant under this conformal group, just like correlation functions in a Euclidean conformal field theory. Okay. In practice, the way we will define these insertions is by just taking the late-time limit of some equal time correlation function in our space and factoring out some power of the time. And our conformal group will act just on the spatial coordinates. Okay. So having described the setup, what is the goal for in our paper and for this talk? So what we want to do is to study the properties of the late time 4-point function, because the 4-point function, let's say, is the lowest point function that contains the information about the full dynamics of the CFT in some specific examples, of course, but also in general. And this is a way to gather information about what are the properties of this Euclidean CFT that lives at the future infinity of a QFT in De Sitter. In particular, the properties of the CFT that we would like to understand is, for instance, whether it admits an operator product expansion, which we will see is related to certain analyticity properties of the four-point function. Or another thing that we would like to understand is how the unitarity of the bulk physics is encoded in this correlation function. Okay. Along the way, to try to understand these problems, we'll also introduce a computational tool, which is a rotation to Euclidean geometry, namely Euclidean ADS space. Okay, so we will see how to relate the computation of these correlation functions to computations in Euclidean ADS. So let me give a slightly more detailed and technical summary of the results so that you know what to expect. So what we're going to do is that we're going to study some late time four-point function. And in a Euclidean conformal field theory, we can always write such a representation for a four-point function, which is called conformal partial wave expansion. So what is this? This can be thought of as some sort of Fourier decomposition with respect to the conformal group, okay? So this is a basis of special functions, which are eigenvalues, eigenvectors of the conformal Casimir with a fixed spin and a fixed dimension, okay? And we have this coefficient function, which when we do this Fourier decomposition, this coefficient function is what encodes all the information about the four-point function, okay? So when I was talking about studying the analyticity properties of the four-point function before, what I meant is really the analyticity property, the analyticity properties of this coefficient function rho. And we will be able to establish in perturbation theory and relying on this rotation to ADS that we describe, we will be able to establish that this function rho actually has just a set of poles, so discrete singularities that will allow us to rewrite this integral expansion as a sum of discrete contributions just by pulling the contour. Okay, so in this we'll have an interpretation of an operator product expansion in the in this Euclidean conformal field theory. Okay, so this is the first thing that we want to establish. And the second thing that we will establish is the consequence of bulk unitarity. And we will see that in this case, the consequence of bulk unitarity is a positivity condition for this function rho. Okay, so this constraint was also studied in this paper by Matthijs, Joao and Cameron that appeared around the same time as ours, and it's also an interesting paper and I recommend. So if you have a series of DS talks, you will also back on them. okay, so now having told you a little bit what we want to do, so the technical, our main results, now I want to tell you some words of motivations. So one first set of motivations comes from the problem of understanding what are the observables in a de Sitter space-time, okay? So strictly speaking, this is not really an issue when we have a quantum field theory in de Sitter space-time, because if you have quantum field theory, you can always define correlation functions of local operators. But it becomes an issue the moment in which we introduce dynamical gravity. Okay, now the common belief in presence of dynamical gravity, coming for instance from our understanding of ADS CFT correspondence, is that observables in this case should correspond to some asymptotic observables on the boundary of the space-time. Okay, and as we just reviewed in the case of the Sitter, the only boundaries that we have are these. Space like past and future boundaries. And perhaps I should have clarified that, I mean, these lines are not real boundaries, they just represent the North Pole or the South Pole of our sphere. Okay. So the only boundaries that we have are these past and future boundaries, and that is what motivates us to study correlation functions there. Moreover, often one is more interested in the expanding part of the geometry rather than the contracting part in the past. And a very practical way to concentrate on the just on the expanding part is to cut the geometry and then define a state at zero time by doing a Euclidean evolution on a half sphere, okay? And this Euclidean evolution of a, so why a sphere? This is because the sphere is just the Euclidean continuation of the De Sitter geometry. So by doing this path integral on a half sphere, one prepares a state, and then one only has the expanding part of the geometry. So this justifies why we can restrict just to the future boundary of the geometry. And this state that we prepare by evolution on a half sphere is the so-called Hartle-Locking state, okay? And it has the property that correlation functions will have, if we take the short distance limit, will behave exactly as the correlation functions in flat space. So they will not be sensitive, as we expect, when we take points to be very close to each other, they should not be sensitive to the curvature. And this is a property of this particular state. So having said that, we can see the study of these correlation functions at future infinity in QFT as a very humble warm up, like as a first exploration of the properties of this Euclidean CFT in the future, and with the goal of maybe in the future trying to understand also how to use it to define observables in quantum gravity. Now, I should clarify that we are still very far from being able to include gravity, and because there are one encounters immediately a lot of difficulties. For instance, if we have dynamical gravities, it's not even clear how we are going to define these insertions because we don't have any more local operators which are gauge invariant in the bulk that we can push the future boundary. And another difficulty, which here I described as IR divergence, is that unlike when we do ADA-CFT, when we do ADA-CFT, we can pick boundary conditions in which sort of the metric shuts down at the boundary, so dynamical. This is not possible in, let's say, if we pick this Hartle-Locking state in the sitter, so we will always have some dynamics for the metric, even at the boundary. So this is another thing which makes the problem much more difficult in presence of dynamical gravity. So here I just wanted to very shortly open a parenthesis for the people among you which might know a bit more about the sitter, just to clarify that there is another object which is very much studied in this context, which is the wave function for this Hartle-Locking state on the defined on this future space-like slice. And this is also related to a Euclidean CFT. And the relation works like this. One can take this wave function and expand it in powers of the field. And then one discovered that the coefficients behave for the similar symmetry arguments, they behave like correlation functions in a Euclidean CFT. So basically this is the statement that the wave function can be thought of as the partition function of a Euclidean CFT where the source is our field, okay? The value of the field on the late time slice. However, it's important to keep in mind that this is not the same CFT that we're talking about now, because what we're talking about now is really the set of correlation functions at late times. And to obtain such a correlation function, starting from the wave function, one still needs to do a lot of work, right? Because how do we define a correlation function? We need to basically do the integral of our observables with some square, some absolute value square of the wave function, okay? So this is just to avoid possible confusion. So we're not talking about the wave function that describes the safety that describes the wave function.
Sorry.
Yes.
Now I got confused. So there are two things that we would call endpoint correlators. The thing that appears in this definition of the wave function, and also the endpoint correlator of the scalars you have in the bottom.
Yes, exactly. So one thing is just taking a correlation function in the bulk and pushing it to late times.
Yeah.
Okay. Another thing is a little bit more formal because you start with something which is not really an observable, which is the wave function. You just take the wave function and you expand it in powers of the values of the fields, right? Because it's a very natural thing to think of your wave function as a function of the value of the fields, and you can expand it, okay? And the coefficients in this expansion also behave by similar symmetry arguments like correlation functions in CFT. Okay, but these are two different CFTs. I mean, we have some comments in our paper about how one might try to relate the two CFTs, but this is not something that is, like, let's say, well understood.
And is one more CFT than the other? Namely, do they both have stress tensors, for example, or does one of them have stress tensors, or none have stress tensors?
Yes, so the one of the correlators, strictly speaking, at the moment, I only know how to define it in the absence of dynamic of gravity. This is what I described here, okay? So taking a correlator in the bulk and pushing it to the late time, this is something that I know how to do very well when there is no gravity, and in this case, I don't get a stress tensor. On the other hand, like formally, if you have gravity in the bulk, then the wave function CFT will have a stress tensor, because imagine expanding this and one of these fields is your metric, okay? Then this will be a correlation function in which there is an insertion of the stress tensor, okay? But then, you see, I still need to do a lot of work to get to some actual correlator. In this case, I would have to do a path integral over the boundary metric.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay?
Yes. Okay, thank you.
So then I want to say briefly before getting to what we did, another set of motivations, which comes from cosmology. So one might be a little worried to talk about this Euclidean correlation function as an observer, because strictly speaking, there is no single observer that can see this full space-like slice inside the sitter. So, however, one setup that you can imagine which this becomes observable is the following. You can imagine to cut your the sitter space-time at some large time, okay, before reaching the future boundary, but very close to it. And then you can attach to it some more ordinary, not exponentially expanding universe, or even just flat space, okay? And you keep going with this. So if you do that, now let's imagine an observer whose word line I drew here with these orange arrows, okay? So now this observer here, this line over here is his so-called co-moving horizon, which means which part of the space can be in causal contact with him, okay? So as he's reaching the future boundary of the sitter, this shrinks. But then when the universe stops expanding exponentially, he will be able to see more and more of this slice as the time goes, okay? So eventually in the future, he will be able to basically access all the surface at large tau, where we cut our the sitter. Okay, so this was just an explanation of in which context the Euclidean CFT actually becomes a very concrete observable. And on the other hand, this is just, you can also think about it as a very rough cartoon of how inflation ends, okay? So when we actually do inflation, one does not have an exact de Sitter universe, one has some inflaton field that introduces has a background value with some time derivative, and this breaks the sitter isometries and introduces some clock, and eventually it leads to the end of the exponentially expanding phase. But to like to zero order approximation, these are the, let's say, the silent features. We stop at some point exponential expansion, and then we have a more conventional not exponential expanding cosmology. So in a sense, this was meant to explain that our CFT that lives at the future infinity can be seen as a zero order approximation for the inflationary correlators that the future observer is going to be able to see in an expansion where the breaking of the sitter isometry is small. Okay, so this in the language of inflation means when we take the slow roll parameters to actually zero. Okay, with this logic in mind, understanding the properties of these late time correlators in the CFT limit can hopefully lead to new constraints or predictions for the inflationary observables once we also understand how to include the small breaking of the sitter isometries. And another aspect is that understanding how to compute these correlation functions on the future boundary can also lead to new techniques can be used also to compute inflationary correlators. Okay, are there questions about this?
Actually, Lorenzo, can I ask? Mm-hmm. You, implicitly, you're saying that the final, like the whatever it is, the infinite time in your de Sitter diagram is the mm-hmm. time slice where inflation ends. And I'm just wondering if that's a good approximation or a good approach. Like, couldn't inflation end on some other time slice or
yeah, well, here I'm imagining that I cannot really end it on the future boundary, so I need to stop it sometime before, but I'm imagining that this time is close, it's very close to the boundary, and then I'm saying that the correlators on this reheating surface are actually very well approximated by the correlators that I computed in the de Sitter limit on the future boundary of the sitter. Yeah. Okay.
Another way to ask the question is, I can approach, I know because I can write down lots of different coordinate systems on de Sitter space, I can approach infinity in different ways. Is mm-hmm. that going to be an issue in these calculations?
Well, you're referring, I guess, for instance, to the fact that I can do the things in global coordinates or Poincaré coordinates. Is that what you had in mind?
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Well, I don't expect so, because, for instance, okay. Poincaré versus global, the late time slices, space-like slices, they are almost coincident in the limit in which this tau becomes large. So, yeah, of course, it's an approximation. But it's one that is often done also in the computation, actual computation of correlations.
Okay.
So it's still useful, let's say, to understand first the CFT limit. Okay, so that was it for the part of the motivations. Now let's get to what we actually did. And I will start with the case of perturbation theory, okay? So let's see what we can say in the case of the perturbative approach. So as I mentioned, what we want to compute is some equal time correlation function, and then take the limit where do we push the time to infinity, and perhaps stripping off some factor of time, and this is going to define our Euclidean CFT correlation function. And we are going to compute these correlation functions in the after locking vacuum that I mentioned before. Now, how do we do this in practice in perturbation theory? Perturbation theory, this requires the so-called in contour. So let me explain it with this formula. What is this formula? When we do perturbation theory, we don't actually have the real non-perturbative vacuum, but we have some perturbation theory vacuum, which is just, if you want, the Fock vacuum, okay? And then we need to, as is perhaps familiar with similar formulas for the S matrix or for time order correlation functions in flat space, we need to insert some factors, which are the time evolution in the interaction picture. And in this case, for computing these equal time correlation functions in this state, we actually need to insert a time order exponential of the interaction on the right, and then anti-time order factor on the left. So, okay, you can think about this as the one that prepares the vacuum on the right, and this as the one that prepares the vacuum on the left, okay? So this is the way we do the calculation in perturbation theory, and now these are just the three fields, as usual, in the interaction picture. And you can also think about it from the path integral point of view as saying that now, inside the path integral, you will have to do an integral in time, which has two branches, okay? In one branch, you have a high epsilon prescription that corresponds to time ordering, okay? So this maps to this part. And on the other branch, you will have a high epsilon prescription that corresponds to anti-time ordering. So this corresponds to this branch, okay? Then I will have my insertions over here. And then I will just expand in powers of H int and do my contractions, okay? That's the way perturbation theory generated. And this contour that goes up and down is called in contour. So now when I do this and I start generating diagrams, I will have to label accordingly my vertices, depending on whether my interaction was lowered from the right or was lowered from the left, okay? So for instance, if I want to do an exchange diagram in phi cube theory, I will have to consider a sum of these four diagrams in which I sprinkled the left and right labels on my vertices. And accordingly, I will also have different type of propagators, okay? I will have left, right, right, left, and right, right propagators. And what these propagators differ from each other in is just the different I epsilon prescriptions. Okay, and here I just told you what are the different epsilon prescriptions. And this S is basically a proxy for the distance between the two points. Okay, let's not go into too much details, but I just need to basically regulate differently the singularity when the two points are on the light cone. And these are what I do with these different I epsilons. Now, the function omega is just a solution of the Klein-Gordon equation. And I'm using this label nu, which is related to the mass in this fashion, okay? So far, is there any question? Okay, so now I can also describe to you more precisely what is this insertion of the operator. So if we take one of the two points to the boundary, okay? This means that this parameter S, which measured the distance, is going to infinity, and we can do an expansion of this function w, and we will see that there are two powers, okay? There is one power which goes like d over 2 minus I nu, and another power which goes like d over 2 plus I nu. Now, we need to distinguish two cases. There are light particles, which in a unit of the radius, they have mass squared smaller than d squared over 4. And in this case, the parameter I nu is a real parameter between 0 and d over 2. Okay. So in this case, we see that the power d over 2 minus I nu is always the dominating one. While in the case of what we'll call heavy particles, so for mass squared bigger than d squared over 4, then the parameter nu is real. And we just have two comparable factors. There is no dominating one, okay? In practice, what we mean when we insert an operator at late time is that we pick a mode of a definite power, okay? So we choose if we want d over 2 minus n or d over 2 plus n, and we strip off the power law, okay? So we're just going to take this limit. This will insert for us the operator on the boundary. And in this procedure, doing this, we will get operators with a definite scaling dimension, which depends on which power we chose, okay? So the scaling dimension would be the over 2 plus mass I know, depending on which power we chose. Okay, questions about this? Okay. So now let me describe the tool that we use to make progress in this perturbation theory. So we don't want to compute all these different left, right, right diagrams. It's very complicated. So a simplification comes from the idea of rotating to Euclidean EDS. Okay. So in order to do that, I will actually restrict myself to what is called the Poincaré patch of the seat, which is basically half of the full geometry, which is the shaded area here in the hyperboloid. So you see that it still contains the full late time boundary, or you can see it as the shaded area here in this in the in the Penrose diagram. And in purple, you see the constant time slices, okay? And conventionally, we call the time eta, and we take it to be negative with the future boundary at eta equals zero, okay? Now, what we do in order to rotate to Euclidean EDS is the following. So I described to you before, that we have some different I epsilon prescription, depending whether our point is on the right part of the contour or on the left part of the contour, which means that we're a little bit above the branch cut or below the branch cut. This is the branch cut arising from the light cone singularity. And what do we do is that we rotate to the imaginary axis in such a way to not cross, of course, the singularity that lies on the negative real axis, okay? And so the eta on the right part of the contour is going to be called now I times z, and the eta on the left part is going to be called minus iz, okay? So why is this Euclidean EDS? Well, just because you can look at the metric in the Poincaré patch, which takes this form, and if you multiply eta by I, you get the metric of Euclidean EDS, also in Poincaré coordinates, but actually you get it up to a very important subtlety, which is the overall sign, okay? You get this minus factor in front. So this is, in a nutshell, is the reason why this procedure, we don't manage to make sense of it beyond perturbation theory, okay? And so this is not like an ordinary weak rotation, it's just some manipulation that leads to good results in perturbation theory. Now, what is Euclidean EDS? Of course, just a brief reminder. So this geometry just described, you can see it as a half space with this metric, okay? And in this case, the CFT lives on the flat boundary here. And I will denote with GADS the propagator in this dimension, okay? And now you can just study what this analytic continuation does on the various propagators. And you see that actually the various propagators have very nice rotation formulas, let's say, which relate them to linear combinations of ADS propagators with parameter nu or minus nu. So in the case of the left-right propagator, which is basically the white one function, you get something proportional to the so-called harmonic function in empty de Sitter, in case you know what it is, otherwise it's not important. While in the case of the time-ordered propagator, you get something very similar, but with some additional factors, which are, let's say, they would be phases if I knew it's real, otherwise they're almost phases times an exponential, okay? And this was also worked out in the language of Mendenbar representation in the papers by Taronna and Slide. So by this procedure, we see that any diagram in the sitter, okay, can be related to a linear combination of diagram in Euclidean empty de Sitter. And one immediate advantage is simply due to the fact that a lot of technology was developed to compute this kind of diagrams, and we can immediately recycle it, okay? So all of these can be also be, like, let's say, economically repackaged by formulating Lagrangian in Euclidean anti-Lissitter space, which automatically, if you take this Lagrangian, generates for you exactly the diagram that computes the late time correlation functions in this Lissitter. Okay? So perhaps it's not necessary to go over all the details, but the idea is that, for instance, if you start with a Lagrangian of a scalar, then you're going to need to introduce actually four fields in a Euclidean anti-Lissitter, because you need both, you see here, you need both the mod with plus nu and the mod with minus nu, but you also need to distinguish a right label and the left label. And what is the definition of these modes? Basically, they're propagators. For instance, let's say phi plus left plus phi plus right is going to be the part with plus nu of the left-right propagator, and so on and so forth, okay? So you see that the left-right propagator has a plus nu part and a minus nu part, and this is the way you define the propagator between these various fields. And when you do this, you actually discover that there is only in the left sector, sorry, in the, let's say, plus sector and in the minus sector, there is only one field that propagates. So you can call it big phi. The other one decouples. And then I will not explain the details, but you can show that you can write, let's say, just doubled in number of fields Lagrangian for these propagating fields, which automatically generates for you the perturbation expansion, the perturbative expansion of the late time correlators of the Lissitter. Now, an important thing is that, of course, this Lagrangian is not that of a unitary theory in anti-Lissitter. You see it, for instance, from the fact that these two factors are opposite to each other. So you're going to have, for instance, ghosts, okay? And also, even if we don't look at this factor, let's say the mass enters with a wrong sign for a Euclidean Lagrangian, and so on and so forth. So it is a Lagrangian which has all sorts of pathologies if we try to interpret it beyond perturbation theory, but it is still a perfectly well-defined Lagrangian to generate Feynman diagrams, or I should say, Wilton diagrams. Okay, so that's the idea. So how can we use this to learn something about the four-point function? Well, the idea is that, now let's remind ourselves a little bit about what we know for Euclidean ADS about boundary four-point functions, okay? So for instance, let's say in perturbation theory. So for instance, let's say we compute some, now I'm drawing Euclidean ADS as the inside of as a disk, okay? So we are computing now some boundary correlation function in Euclidean ADS. And we will have some perturbative expansion. For instance, I draw here the divergent phi cube. Now, one thing that we do know is that if we study the analog conformal partial wave decomposition for this four-point function in anti-Lissitter. So let me explain a little bit better what before I said a bit faster. So this function we call spectral density. This is the conformal partial wave, and the conformal partial wave can be rewritten as a sum of two terms, okay? One is a conformal block, and the other one is the shadow conformal block, okay? So how do we go from here to the OP expansion of the four-point function? Well, we start with this integral over the real axis, okay? Then we need to pick this or this term, depending whether we want to close the contour up or down. Okay, then once we break this degeneracy between up and down, we choose, and then we push the contour, and we get some sum over poles. Okay, so one thing that we do know about these correlation functions in ADS is that the function rho will just have a discrete set of poles on the new imaginary axis. And we know that because we know that these are good Euclidean conformal field theory, which admits a Gaupi expansion and is unitary. Okay, so this is in the case where we have a unitary theory in Euclidean anti-Lesieter. Okay, so again, what we said is that the pole of rho encode of P, and from the unitarity of the boundary CFT, we know that the poles will be on the imaginary axis. Are there questions about this? Okay, so here I say it again. Rho with poles correspond to having a discrete P expansion. Now, actually, in the case of Euclidean ADS, and where we have some unitary theory in the bulk, this is actually something that we know even beyond perturbation theory. The reason why we know that even beyond perturbation theory is because we have a tool, a very powerful tool, which is the state operator correspondence. Okay? So suppose that on the boundary of our ADS, I have 2 points, okay? And I want to rewrite these 2 insertions as a sum over local insertions. Well, what I'm gonna do is that I'm gonna choose some half sphere, okay, such that its boundary surrounds the 2 points, okay? And then I can just use the isometries to shrink this sphere, and eventually this is going to be written as an insertion, as a sum of insertion of local operators. Okay, so this is why we know that the OP exists in the case of Euclidean ADS. Now, we don't have such a tool in the sitter, but we just saw that at the perturbative level, at the perturbative level, it does coincide with a non-unitary theory in Euclidean ADS. Okay, so now when we introduce these non-unitarities in ADS, what do we expect to happen? Well, again, at the level of perturbation theory, the only thing that can happen is that these poles will move around a little bit. They will not be anymore on the imaginary axis as they were before because of the unitarity. They will just start moving off the axis, but it will not change the property of having just a set of discrete poles. Okay, that's the logic that we use. And from this logic, we conclude that at least to all orders in perturbation theory, these correlation functions in the future boundary of the sitter still have a rho function which has only poles. Okay, and once we know it has only poles, again, we can do the same that we did in ADS. We can push the contour to infinity and replace the integral with a discrete sum. Okay, so this is what we call like OP in this late time conformal field theory. Okay, and I want to stress that this is not at all obvious because we couldn't derive this based on a state operator correspondence in the sitter. There is no such a thing as a we cannot pick a space-like slice that shrinks to a point in the boundary of the sitter. You see, if I take a space-like slice, what it does is that it gets larger and larger, and I don't have something that shrinks to a point like I have in Euclidean ADS. Okay, so this is our first main conclusion that we wanted to reach. If there are no questions, I will move to the second. Okay, so the second thing that we want to discuss is unitarity. So again, it's good to contrast with the case of the Euclidean ADS. In the case of the Euclidean ADS, unitarity is encoded just by the fact that our CFT in the boundary is going to be a unitary CFT. So we're going to have dimensions above the unitarity bound, and we're going to have positive square root P coefficient. Okay, on the other hand, we already saw that for this late time CFT on the future boundary of the sitter, we have complex dimensions. So clearly, it is not the case here that we have a unitary CFT in the standard sense.
Sorry, Lauren, just a quick question.
Yes.
couldn't you get some more subtle behavior of this row at infinity? So I understand that you are doing perturbation theory. So if you start with Euclidean EDS, the poles get shifted around a little bit. That's a small effect. On top of that, couldn't you get some nastier asymptotic behavior of this row function at infinity, that some singularity coming from infinity at large nu?
You mean you're worried about the possibility that the integral will stop converging or something like that?
So we start with something which is meromorphic, right, in ADS.
Yeah. Sure.
And now we are deforming a meromorphic function.
Yes.
How can we argue? So one possibility is that the function is still meromorphic, but the poles just get shifted around a little bit.
Yes.
How do we argue that we don't get crazier things? For example, we could have a pole that opens up into two square root cuts. Or we could have singularities coming from infinity. How do we argue so fast that just because we started a meromorphic function, as we deform, we keep a meromorphic function? Naively, you see, we could have two poles, two square root colliding that give a pole. And then I deform and they become a square root.
Right.
Why can't I get crazy?
So the point is that I'm not deforming in a random way. I'm deforming in a way that is still encoded in a local Lagrangian in ADS, even though it's a Lagrangian which has bad non-unitarity property, like it has ghosts and it has tachyonic masses and whatnot, but still it is a local Lagrangian ADS. So I don't see how in perturbation theory I could get something different from just poles. It's not like an arbitrary deformation.
Maybe the question is, what do you think are the analytic properties beyond perturbation theory? Do you think they continue to be meromorphic or?
Well, that if you want is a bit of a hope. And but so in order to understand that, you would need to have some non-perturbative understanding of what could be this discreteness that we see here, okay? So we have some suggestion in this direction in terms of quasi-normal modes in the static patch of the seat. So if that pans out and works, then of course this would give you, so let's say that this suggestion gives us some hope that indeed this structure could survive also at the non-perturbative level, but at the moment it's just a conjecture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically that was my question. Okay, thank you.
Okay, so what I was saying is that, so while clearly it's not true that our boundary CFT, our late time boundary CFT is unitary, that is not true, but we still have a unitary time evolution in the bulk, right? We have a Hilbert space in the bulk, and we would like to understand if this gives some consequences for this Euclidean CFT. So it's not going to be ordinary unitary, it's going to be something else. So how do we do that? Well, in order to do that, it's useful to recall that the bulk states, okay, so we want to use the bulk Hilbert space. The bulk states can be labeled using unitary reducible representations of the sitter isometries, okay? What are those? Well, there is basically what we called before heavy particles belong to a representation that has the name of principal series, okay? And again, this means that the parameter nu is real. And then there are other representations that correspond to light particles, which are called complementary, and this is indeed the case where I nu is real that I mentioned before. There might also be other things, but that's not gonna play a role in our discussion. So what is the idea now to use the unitarity of the bulk to prove something about the CFT? The idea is to insert a complete set of bulk states inside our correlation function, okay? As simple as that, to try to get something which looks like absolute value squared, okay? So as a warm up, and even though I have only 10 minutes, so maybe, okay, but I think this is still pedagogical, otherwise it's hard to understand. So as a warm up, let's do the bulk two-point function, okay? So if I have a bulk two-point function, like a, let's say, Whiteman two-point function of this sort, Then I can start inserting inside between the two operators just a resolution of the identity. So it will be a part which is sum over all the states in the tier in the principal series, plus blah, blah, blah. Now, what do I gain from this? What I gain from this is that I'm going to get an integral of this sort, okay, which is a sum over, now I'm concentrating over the principal series for simplicity. I'm getting a sum over contribution like this. And you see that it starts looking a bit like modulus squared, okay? So how can I really argue for the positivity? Well, the observation is that since I have states with definite properties under the sitter isometries, I can prove that I can prove that this object, if I act with a Laplacian on, say, the point Tx, okay, I can prove easily that this behaves exactly like a solution of the Klein-Gordon equation with mass that is fixed by the parameter nu. Okay, that's the first observation. So as a consequence, I conclude that this object over here must be what? Must be a factor, which I don't know, times this white bound propagator, just because of the it's a solution of this differential equation. Okay, and then the next step is to just take this coefficient rho, okay, and try to eliminate the dependence on the points between these two phis and the and the Whiteman function in such a way that I get a manifestly positive ratio. Okay, so one way to do that in the case of the tuple function is to take both these points, both here in the Whiteman function, and rotate them to the Euclidean sphere. Okay, I can do that. Then I can put the two points on the sphere symmetric with respect to the equator. Okay, so if I do that, the numerator now really becomes just a modulus squared, which is positive. And I can prove that also the denominator, which now is going to be some propagator on the Euclidean sphere, I can prove that also this quantity is positive, at least when we are sufficiently close to the equator. Okay, so and this proves for me that this coefficient rho must be positive. Okay. And we do basically the same for the four-point function. So let's say we take now a late time four-point function. Again, what we're going to do is that we're going to separate the operators in two groups, and we're going to insert inside a resolution of the identity in the bulk written in terms of some other bulk states. Now, unlike before, in which I had scalar operators, here I'm forced to consider also spin. I cannot be lazy and just go to spin zero. I need to sum over all the spins. And I can basically repeat the same logic. So first of all, there is a part of noticing that this solves some differential equation. Okay, what do? I act with the conformal Casimir, and I notice, just due to the fact that they have this projector here, I notice that this solves exactly the equation of a conformal partial wave. Okay, this part is very easy. And then I conclude that this must be some coefficient, here is our function rho j, times the conformal partial wave, okay? Now, finally, I need to find some configuration of points in which the ratio between these two becomes positive, and then I'm done, because rho doesn't depend on the points, right? It's just a coefficient. So this is basically what we did. Maybe I can skip the details. I can just tell you that by choosing a property, some configuration of points, you can indeed show that this ratio becomes an absolute value squared divided by a positive function. And this is the way we prove that this function, this coefficient rho, also must be positive. Okay. Are there questions about this?
I have a naive question. You should have many solutions to this differential equation, right?
Again, repeat.
You should have many solutions to this differential equation, right?
Yeah, very good. That's true. But there are also some boundary conditions. And the conformal partial wave is the one that, for instance, is single valued when you move the points around, and also has some specific properties when you take coincident point limits. So you also need to verify that. You need to, in order to conclude that really this is a constant times the conformal a partial wave. You do need to check also these boundary conditions are satisfied, and they are.
Thanks.
Okay, so I'm almost at the end of my talk. So what should I mention? Let me see. So here I just wanted to show you one example in which we computed indeed this function rho in perturbation theory, and we checked both the positivity and the analyticity. So we did it in the context of cubic theory, where we have some light operators interacting with a heavy one. So maybe I will not go through the details of this first part. So this is just basically using the strategy that I described before, rotating to Euclidean ABS. And in this way, you can get the conformal partial wave expansion. Perhaps one of the most interesting points of this calculation is that if you do that, you see that actually your rho introduces, supposing that the particle sigma is heavy, introduces a pole exactly on the integration contour, okay? So what's the resolution of that? Well, we show that the resolution of that is that actually very similarly to what happens also in flat space, you need to consider corrections to the propagators of the heavy particle, okay? We can explicitly compute those. I'll not explain the details of this, but computing these corrections, you can show that indeed the poles shift from the integration contour and they move a little bit on one side, okay? So physically, this means that the heavy particle sigma, due to the interaction with the light particle phi, you can interpret it as the fact that it became a resonance, okay? It became a resonance and the pole moved from the integration contour. And perhaps one thing that I can highlight is that this function rho that we introduce has actually a very specific feature in the vicinity of this resonance, which looks a little bit like bright Wigner, but not really, because it's a bit asymmetric like this. And so we are like hopeful that maybe in the future this could have some practical application, for instance, to detect sort of resonances in inflationary correlators. But okay, this is still this first thing to understand how to improve breakings of the sitter isometries, but at least that's a hope. Okay, so this was a bit fast, but I hope to accommodate some. And finally, maybe I can just say in 1 minute, comment about what Pedro was asking me before. So one very natural question is, what is the physical origin of this operator product expansion that we seem to see, at least in perturbation theory? By the way, I forgot to mention something that just comes to my mind. The proof of the positivity that comes from unitary, that does not rely on perturbation theory, okay? That was a proof that is not perturbative. It's only the analyticity, or if you want, the existence of VOP, that at the moment we only control in perturbation theory, okay? And so I was saying, what could be the physical origin of VOP? So one suggestion is that it could be related to the physics of the so-called static patch. What is the static patch? A static patch is basically the part of the sitter which an actual observer inside can is in causal contact with. And why this sounds like a reasonable suggestion. So one reason is that it touches, one very heuristic reason is that the static patch touches just one point at the future boundary. So somehow it might be connected to local operators in the future boundary. Okay, this is a bit heuristic. Another motivation is that there is a set of discrete set of complex frequencies that is naturally associated to this static patch, which are the quasi-normal modes of this cosmological horizon that the observer sees here. And it has been observed that these complex frequencies are in one-to-one correspondence with the power law decays in, for instance, two-point functions when we take one point very, very close to the boundary, okay? So there is a correspondence between the frequencies of quasi-normal modes and the decay of correlation functions. So one natural conjecture that one can make is that actually the location of these OP poles that we see coincides with the frequency, with the frequencies of quasi-normal modes in a static patch of the sitter. There is a set of cases in which we can prove this, but this, like, it's a restricted example. It's just, for instance, we can prove it in the case where we have some, let's say, exchange diagram with some composite exchange, let's call it like that, for lack of better words. So in this case, you can actually see that there is a correspondence between these poles in the OP and the powers that appear in the late time decay of this two-point function. Okay, this is something we prove, but we don't know more generally. Okay, so that's something we want to think about. And moreover, it's not clear, at least to us at the moment, whether these quasi-normal modes can have some kind of Hilbert space interpretation. And this is discussed a little bit by these authors. This would be nice because perhaps can lead to some sort of Hilbert space interpretation of the space of operators. Okay, so this concludes basically my talk. Let me just say what we want to do in the future besides trying maybe to understand a little bit better this relation to quasi-normal modes. So one thing that we want to do is to finish, we have already have some results, and we want to finish studying also the case of, let's say, a theory not equal coupling. So for instance, dual model with quartic interaction at large n can also be studied using these techniques on the sitter. And we can see what's the nature of the late time CFT in that case. Something that I also briefly mentioned before is that it would be nice to clarify a little bit the relation between the CFT of the wave function and the CFT of the correlators. And of course, to have phenomenological applications at some point, it would be nice to understand precisely how to include to the CFT limit to correct it by including breakings of the sitter isometry and to actually get inflationary correlators. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Let's all thank Lorenzo.
Thank you.
What a beautiful talk. And I have a few questions, but let me open for everyone else first. Don't be shy. So let me ask one while people think, just an obvious one. So could you now devise some bootstrap, some numerical bootstrap for studying theories in the sitter?
Well, I think the relevant reference for this is the paper by Joao, Matthijs, and Cameron. And they certainly try to set it up, mm-hmm. but I still haven't studied it in detail, so I don't want to misrepresent what he did. But yes, in principle, it's possible to try to do it using this different positivity constraint.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask another a naive question. I remember at some point there was some paper, I think by Juan and by other people, about trying to embed the sitter in ADS, in some usual ADS CFT examples. There were a way of putting some DS inside. And recently there were some papers by Giombe and Seidlin and so on to putting an ADS2 inside an ADS5 by putting some Wilson line. And then the theory on the defect was a theory on ADS2. Could we do something similar and have some kind of other type of defect where the world sheet would be a DS2, for example?
And... defect or the world sheet would be a DS2.
Yeah, does it make sense? Am I saying something crazy? So what the one I'm saying is you put a Wilson line, a circular Wilson line, say, and the worldsheet of that string is an ADS2. Could I consider another observable where now the worldsheet of that string would be a DS2 and then use that new observable as a non-perturbative definition of a theory with the on DS2 and use it as a laboratory for testing these ideas? Maybe some Wilson line that ends on some time-like curve or something inside instead of a space-like circle.
I don't know. I noticed that there is also short-time vector around. I don't know if they have some.
You can easily add a difficult preserves the visitor to symmetries.
Could you say again, John?
I think you can put a defect that preserves the Sitter-2 symmetry. And that's it.
I think you can do that. Actually, like there are like a recent paper by Takanagi on the ADS BCFT and wedge holography, which kind of discusses that. And the idea is, well, if you want to do it for the Wilson line, I think you need to put the Wilson line at a constant time slice, like a two Wilson lines at a different constant time slice, then like there can be a solution which connects these two Wilson lines. And one Wilson line is like a future infinity and the other one is the past mm-hmm. infinity.
Mm-hmm.
That I think can be, it's possible for probably.
So you mean that you need to into some space like defect?
Right, but that is, yeah, that I can imagine, but like that is more like a DSS matrix in which you fix the mm-hmm. future boundary and the past boundary. But mm-hmm. here, like what Lorenzo talked about is more like a DS correlator, and that I'm not sure how to get it.
Sorry, I'm not sure I understood. So from what you just described, can't I just put some insertions on the Wilson line to make
Yeah, you can put the insertion on the Wilson line on the top and on the bottom.
Right.
And that like a specify both in state and out state.
But I could put just on the top and then it will be similar to what...
But still you need to somehow make sure that you're really computing the Hartle-Lorentz state. And Schott is saying that if you have some generic defect, then it's not clear.
Yeah, because like if you just put like an insertion on the top Wilson lines, that's a bit like a computing the wave function of the universe. Mm-hmm. Because you are not doing this like a Schringer Kildes like integral, it's more like a single integral. So
I see. So the question is how to embed this nucleation state. That's the
right one.
But this was what Juan described, no? There was a paper just by Juan many years ago, 10 years ago or something. Wasn't it exactly about this?
Maybe.
I thought it was about putting some de Sitter inside the ADS, but okay.
Yeah, I don't remember, so I cannot say.
Yeah, I might be confused as well. No, very nice. Other questions? Well, if there are no more questions, let's thank Lorenzo again for a beautiful talk. And let's meet again next week, same time for the Sitter part two.